Hi, my name is Chip Spear and you're listening to Earth Plus 30. Today's guest is a very captivating, compelling woman. I think she's a very inspirational speaker as well. Her name is Jill Kubit. She's co-founder of an organization called Dear Tomorrow. She and her co-founding partner, Tricia Shrum, started this organization and approached climate change and energy issues from a completely different angle than one that I had ever considered or one that I knew anything about. Rather than relying a lot on fear and scare tactics and a lot of statistics, she approached things from a different angle. She had people write letters to the future, and specifically to their future children or their family or their friends. The approach was one of love, not scaring, and trying to make the world a better place for our future children, our future families, and just generally everybody on Earth. Jill is a really accomplished woman. She has a BA from Northwestern and a master's from the Harvard Kennedy School in Public Administration. And she and Tricia, I think, are really on to something quite wonderful. Before I introduce you, though, I want to read one of the letters to give you a flavor of what I'm talking about, because I think it will set the stage for our discussion and give you a better understanding of why this was so interesting to me. It was a letter written by Anonymous. Dear Future Earth, how are you doing? I hope you're doing a lot better than you are now. I hope human beings see the harm they are causing you, and if they don't change, one day there will no longer be a you. I hope that you are once again filled with beautiful forests, diverse wildlife, and clean, crisp air. As of the moment, I'm enjoying the time I have with you and exploring all the beauty you have to offer. While writing this letter, I'm bobbing to Bruno Mars's 24K Magic. Amazing song, really, but not as amazing as you. Corny, right? Now, when it comes to writing and expressing my thoughts, I'm not the best. And you can ask my college profs about that. But I hope you are healthy and happy and providing a safe home for any family members that I have in the future. I sincerely apologize for all the pain we have caused you in the years that I am writing this. But as a species that has come from you, I hope that we as a species have realized how much we need to live a healthy life. Well, this is as far as I thought I could write. So I'm going to go now. Stay safe, my home. With that, I want to introduce you to Jill. Welcome, Jill.
Well, thank you, Chip. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk about the project, and I really love that you selected some letters that you want to read. And it's interesting for me to sit and listen to it, as I'm usually the person who's going and reading through all of the letters. So I want to thank you for that. So, you know, as you said, I co-founded this project called Dear Tomorrow in 2015. And I'll get into it a little bit later about, you know, what exactly the project is. But I came to this project with a background of having worked in the climate movement since 2006. Mm-hmm. And I'd always worked in areas with, like, thinking about how climate change impacts people. And so that work was working with the trade union movement and really trying to understand what a transition to a low carbon economy means for workers, communities, and really for people. And so I've been doing a whole bunch of work around leadership development and education and coalition building in the climate change area. But it wasn't until 2013 when I first had a child that I really started to think differently about climate change. And I started to think about it instead of thinking about teaching climate change and explaining it to people in terms of data and statistics and kind of a very information heavy way of thinking about climate change. I really started thinking about it much more in kind of a personal and emotional way. And then this kind of experience of having a kid and thinking about climate change brought me to this project. And so in 2015, I met a woman named Tricia Shrum, who is the co-founder of Dear Tomorrow. And she was also a new mother. She had a 10-month-old, and my son, Gabriel, was about a year and a half when we met. And she had written a letter to her daughter. The letter was about how she thought about climate change, and it was a reflection process for her to think about not only how she thinks about it, but what she's actually doing. And so she sat down, she wrote a letter to her daughter, and she wanted her daughter to open it up in the future. And when I heard this story, I thought this was kind of an amazing idea. If we who are parents or grandparents or aunts and uncles, or we're young people, if we can kind of think into the future and think about people who we actually know living in these years, what's the world going to look like in 2030 or 2050? But if we're actually thinking about people we love living during that time frame, does that change how we're acting now? Anyway, Dear Tomorrow was basically born through this collaboration that I had with Tricia, and we created a website, and we're trying to build a community of people who are sharing personal stories about climate change in order to make climate change feel more relevant to people's own lives.
So tell me a little bit about that. You want to share these stories. How did you construct this website, and why did you build it the way that you did? And how are you reaching out to this audience, both from a website and maybe beyond? Because I'm sure that you have outreach or something that's going on as well, right?
Yeah. These are great questions. We built a website platform. It's called Dear Tomorrow. It's www.deartomorrow.org. And it's a place where any person or, you know, group or organization can go to the site and participate in the project. And what people do is they imagine basically that they're imagining someone that they know and love now. And they're imagining that person living in the year 2050, you know, that person going to their mailbox, if there is a mailbox, or, you know, imagine that person opening up a letter or getting a video or seeing a photo. And through that letter, video, or photo, we're basically telling the story about what we're doing to make sure that they have a safe and secure future. Go ahead.
Well, I was saying that one of the reasons I'll tell the audience that this was so compelling to me is because Earth Plus 30 is projecting out 30 years in the future, sitting at a dining room table and asking yourself, what did I do to get not only me to this place, but my family, my community, my state, my country, my world, looking at that future and asking not quite the same questions, because I don't want to say it's the same, but there's a certain how did I get here type of thing. And what did we want to build at that point, right?
I think that you and I discussed that the time frame of Earth Plus 30, and I think the time frame of Dear Tomorrow is very similar. And I think there have been other legacy projects that have been done and other letters to the future. And they're often framed as, what kind of Earth are we going to leave for future generations? And they ask, sometimes there's one in particular, but they ask people to imagine like your grandchildren's grandchildren or multiple generations from now. And when people think in that like very long-term future, it's a lot of the material that comes is, I'm sorry, we didn't do anything. It's a lot about regret and fear and apocalyptic visions. But that's thinking about something that is not tangible. It's so far in the future. It's very distant. We wanted to bring that distance closer in and ask those kind of similar questions, but with somebody that you actually know and care about, or if you're a young person, yourself living in that year 2050. So, you know, if you're a young person today and you're 20 years old right now, you are going to be, do the math, like 53 years old in the year 2050. You're still going to be around. You would be in the height of your career. You might have a family of your own. It's not somebody else's world. It's actually our world. And the same for a parent. I had this very profound, my own experience of thinking about my son's life in Dear Tomorrow. And I've given a bunch of lectures on climate change and talked to people about it. And I used to say, like, in the year 2020, we need to, you know, reduce carbon emissions by this certain percent, or in the year 2030 or the year 2050. But that always felt very distant. And then when I had my kid, I started thinking, like, well, in the year 2020, actually, he'll be in the first grade, or in the year 2030, he would be getting ready to graduate from high school. And in the year 2050, he would be basically about my age. That kind of really transitioned my own thinking on time frame. So I think it's important that we're not too distant into the future, and that we're actually connecting it to ourselves and to people that we already know.
There's a very short quote that I found on your site that I really liked. It was an anonymous quote saying, "The question I kept asking myself in these last 2 days is, if not us, then who? And if not now, then when will we care about these long-term and bigger problems? And I think that really ties into exactly what you were saying. Like, when are we going to do it if we don't do it now? What are we going to wait for? And I think that what you're doing is just so important. Maybe can you read something that you yourself, I know you go through probably hundreds and hundreds of these letters and quotes that people post, but something that really appeals to you or touches you?
So we actually just went through the process of reading all of the 2017 letters and kind of figuring out which ones of them resonated the most with us. And we came up with 10 letters that we just really, really love and that we wanted to share more broadly. And so this is just an excerpt from one of them. And this was written by a woman named Krista, who's a student at the Florida Gulf Coast University. And her letter is entitled Dear Tomorrow. Mm-hmm. She says, I'm generally fearful that I will not be able to show my own grandchildren the town I grew up in because it will have been washed away years before they were born. The road that I learned to ride my bike on, the field where I kicked my first soccer ball, and the park where I ate my first ice cream cone could all be gone. And then, you know, she goes on in the letter to talk about her actions. And I think it struck me that her actions were not like, I'm going to change my light bulbs or I'm going to, you know, ride my bike to school, which are, these are important individual actions, but she kind of takes it to another level. And she says that she's going to open her mouth and speak the unspoken and take the impossible and make it possible and be a steady mind in the unsteady catastrophe. And I think that it's like, she just understands to a much greater degree, like what we're facing and what she's likely to face in her lifetime. And I was really moved by her letter.
Tell me a little bit about what you're doing to reach beyond your website with these letters. I ask that because there certainly is a substantial part of our country that just will not or does not believe or does not want to believe, or I don't even know how to adequately explain their approach or attitude, but it is pretty depressing. And you seem to offer an alternative to the statistical approach. How are you getting that message out and how effective do you find your being? Tell me a little bit about that story.
Okay. I'm just going to back up a little bit. I just wanted to touch on a couple points about climate change communications and how we've been communicating on climate change, and then talk about like how we're approaching it. I think it would be helpful.
Great.
So I think the population of the United States, but also globally, there's been a way that people have been thinking about climate change. This is certainly true in the United States. This is also true in a lot of developed countries or Western countries. There's a couple things that come about when people think about climate change, and you and I we've already kind of talked about them. And one of them is distance. And that is that people feel like the issue is very distant to their current lives. And even though this 2017 was filled with more extreme weather and climatic events around hurricanes and wildfires and recent cold weather, most people in the United States aren't really feeling it in their actual day-to-day lives. And so we have this problem of distance that people feel with the issue. We also have another subset of people that feel very overwhelmed by the issue. Like, it's a global issue. It's connected to everything in our lives, how we go to work, how our communities are built, our house, how we go turn on the lights and drive to work, and basically how we eat our food. It's part of our entire lives. And so that it often feels like the shift that needs to occur is very overwhelming, that the individual things that we could actually do, it's really hard for people to see how they could add up to something really big.
Right.
So there's this overwhelming problem. I think particularly in the United States, there's this, and you were alluding to this, there's this highly like politicized issue, which is that it's become over the last 10 years very polarized in the U.S., and so people's likelihood of actually believing in climate change has more to do with their political affiliation than almost anything. And a lot of the research that goes into why that's happening has kind of pointed to this idea that people who are more conservative thinking might vote Republican. They're not happy or excited about the solutions that are being proposed. And so those solutions are often government coming in. They're more likely to turn away from the solutions because they don't like the solutions, the turn away from the problem. Does that make sense? think I explained it in might have roundabout way. But the idea of that it's become super polarized, but some of it has to do with what's being proposed and what the solutions are. And then that's turning people away.
Jill, I very much like your point about the government coming in and imposing solutions. The Republicans have been incredibly successful at turning people against the government, reinforcing that Reagan idea that government is not the solution, but rather it's actually the problem. Even if there's a very effective and efficient way to solve a problem, if the government comes in and proposes it, then many people are against it just by the very nature of the messenger rather than the actual message. And I think that that comes into play here to some degree.
Yeah, so that point there really is that people are opposed to kind of the solutions, mm-hmm. then they'll be opposed to the problem itself. Right. So that is one reason why it's become extreme, why it's become polarized. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're trying to do is trying to find like common values that people share across ideology, across, you know, religion, international boundaries, and that is the values around family and legacy and parenting. And that if we can think about climate change kind of through this lens of love and start to begin to think about it in this new way and tell stories about how people care about climate change because they're parents or because they're teachers or because they're young and they're thinking about their mm-hmm. future, then that is what we're trying to do. We're trying to connect with people with the values that they already hold instead of saying, you should care about the environment and we're going to try and tell you what to care about. We're saying, like, trying to reverse it and say, we know you care about your family. Part of caring about your kids is ensuring that they have a safe and secure
right.
future. And part of that is dealing with climate change.
And what parent doesn't want that for their kids? Right? One thing that I thought was really coincidental to some degree was I listened to a podcast this past week of Hidden Brain. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but they had this one particular podcast called I'm Right, You're Wrong. And mm-hmm. they specifically were talking about how to convince people to change their minds and their actions. So much of what they were identifying as effective methods of change was to appeal to people's emotions. You know, as Trump has appealed to people's fears, I was thinking about you and your organization and how you're looking at hope and wanting to provide the best for your family and your children and your children's children. And the podcast used a number of specific examples on how that works in different situations, but it really brought to mind everything that you're doing and how different it was than so many other organizations who are trying to deal with this same problem. And I just thought, wow, that is incredible. I think that you're really on to something.
Yeah, I think that storytelling and having people kind of create their own mm-hmm. narratives is something that we haven't done enough mm-hmm. of. There are definitely great organizations out there that are trying to organize parents, and there are some interesting creative projects out there, but we just need more. We need more of them. I think what you're saying, it's pretty well documented that facts and data, they don't move people's, they don't change people's minds, and they don't move people in a way that stories or things that we see in popular culture right. or what stories that our friends tell us, like those are the things that influence mm-hmm. us. So we're trying to use that and tap into that. But one thing I would say, and I think you asked earlier, like how do we reach beyond the right. base to reach other people. One thing we're really, really interested in, this might sound a little wonky, there's this gap between the people who identify themselves as concerned about climate change. Mm-hmm. There's a gap between those people and people who are hearing about climate change from somebody that they know. So Yale has done a lot of great research on climate change communications. They did this great study. It's called the Six Americas. And it basically looks at, in the United States, where are people on a range from alarmed and concerned to the doubtful and dismissive. They found that more than 50% are in the first two categories, which are the most concerned, which is alarmed and concerned. And only 9% of the people were in this like dismissive, denying, we don't care about this issue. And so we know that most people do care, but the second point I was trying to get in there is that people aren't actually hearing other people that they know say that they care. And so there's data that says something like only 20% of people hear somebody that they know in their life talk about climate change on a monthly basis. So that just means that we're not actually talking about it. And so part of our project is to provide people tools and resources and a frame to think about climate change, make a commitment, write something down, and then share it with somebody.
So how are you doing that? Tell me a little more.
The platform is available, or the website is available for anybody to publish a letter. And the letters are all then publicly available and then can be shared on through social media. So we encourage people who are participating in the project to then take their story and send it to some of their friends or find a place where they can talk about the project or do the project or share their letter. And so we've had examples of some of this is going to sound very anecdotal, but we've had examples of people calling us and saying that they brought it to their church and their pastor read it to their congregation.
Wow.
Or they did the project and then they found five of their friends to do the project as well. We also have a photo project. So we've had people who've done the project who've asked, can I set up a booth at an event? And then they've gotten other people to do it. And so it's kind of this idea of there's a participation piece, but then there's also a sharing piece, and then there's also an organizing piece. Like, can you organize 5 people or 10 people or 20 people in your community to also do the project? And so we're just now starting to see little groups of people who in different parts of the country that are doing the project, which is really, really interesting. This is kind of funny, but when we first did the project, we had a certain website that was kind of clunky, and we just collected the letters, and we didn't collect like a lot of information about the people. And we transitioned and made our website more automated. And when we did that, we just started collecting zip codes.
Oh.
And we started noticing we would get 10 letters from the same zip code.
Wow.
And say, we don't know anybody who lives there.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so then I would reach out to somebody and say, did somebody organize a Dear Tomorrow letter writing? Or did somebody do like a photo project? And then they would say, oh, this person decided to do it. And this is how I got involved. And that's happened in California, Massachusetts, Florida, Kansas City, Pittsburgh, and Chicago.
Wow.
So it's kind of popping up in different places, which is really interesting.
Are you finding it's starting to move into, I guess, more of the red states of the country, down south and in the Great Plains or areas like that out west?
We haven't yet. It's been pretty random, like the locations that have come up, except that in the last 4 or 5 months, I've had inquiries both in Florida and in Houston, which has been really interesting. So directly following the hurricanes, somebody saying that this is a project that they want to do within their community. So that's been a recent development. In terms of red state, it'll be interesting to see what happens in 2018.
Right.
We'll get like 5 letters or 20 letters from the same place, no prior contact.
That's fascinating.
So Jill, what about growth? I mean, marketing, building your brand and that sort of thing. I mean, you've got such an incredible message and such a great organization. How do you build it and go beyond the barriers that are preventing you from expanding and getting out? I mean, money is always an issue, of course. What kind of strategy do you have?
Well, it's like the funding is definitely the number one challenge. And that is like all projects and all entrepreneurs. I think one challenge I'm dealing with right now is how do we build a team? And how do we do have a team of people who are mostly volunteers? We have myself, I'm actually a paid staff, but we have 3 interns, and then we have probably 10 organizers who are out in the field who have done the project multiple times. My challenge for me is if I have this like volunteer staff kind of structure, because we're small right now, how do I build that through building relationships with people and giving people responsibility and ownership over the project?
Do you think that having a nonprofit that relies so heavily on volunteers is a huge challenge? It would certainly be nice if more money was available for something like what you do.
It's a challenge I think that all social entrepreneurs face, and that is this balance between how do you build something as big as you can on limited mm-hmm. resources versus how do you spend your time just going out and fundraising. And somebody once gave me this vision of being in a boat. This has really stuck with me. His advice was, if you're in a boat and you're going and you basically go in the boat as far and as fast as you can, and the more that you go in the boat, the bigger the wake will be. And as the wake gets bigger, it will pull more and more people in. And so the idea is basically, with or without funding, it's like take your idea as far mm-hmm. as you can and create your own mm-hmm. momentum. And as you create that momentum, it will be forced to grow. And I always think about that a lot as I'm trying to build something with limited resources.
That's a really beautiful vision, actually, for not only what you're doing, but I think for everybody. It's trying to do anything. You know, that's a very inspiring thought, because I think that it's true. You know, you infect people with your passion, and the more passionate you are, and by nature of the more passion, I guess you put in more effort, you work harder at it, and people see you doing that, and you are more successful with everything that you're touching. I think that's really true. If I was to ask, you know, where do you see this organization in, say, 15 years? What would you say? How would you say it evolves?
Well, the original conception of the project is to have this open project from the year 2015, right. excuse me, to the year 2020, mm-hmm. and to have a space where people are creating and sharing stories about climate change action. And the original concept is then actually to close down the archive at 2020 or at some point, and then to reopen it in the future. So then you're asking 15 years down the line would be from the original conception would be 2030. And so the idea would be to bring back the archive in kind of a big public way and display these letters to say, like, this is how people were thinking about climate change during this period of time. And so the letter writers and the recipients can actually see kind of what was communicated. So it is a living time capsule project with this idea of bringing back the material in these years that are on paper considered important, 2030 and 2050, although nature will run its own course. So we can't quite pinpoint what the world will look like. So that's the kind of idea for the project. But I do think we're still flexible enough in this stage of mm-hmm. the project that if in 2020 it's rapidly expanding and we're working in various countries, we wouldn't just say like, okay, we're just going to shut it down. Like it's the end of 2020. We'll kind of see how it goes and how it progresses.
Yeah, what does Jill do in 2021? Are you down on the beach or will you wait? I'm going to wait 10 years and then we're going to reopen this. It's like, well, I did my thing.
Well, no, I mean, I think the idea really was, because when we first started, we had no idea if we could raise any mm-hmm. money, if we could ever pay anybody to work on this. The idea was that, you know, I was signing up for, like, I'm going to basically work on this with no right. pay for 6 years, which was a huge commitment. And I did work for free for the first year and a half on the project. And then I've been able to raise some money and pay myself some money to pay my bills and to be able to travel and go to conferences
and do exhibits
and stuff. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. I still do a lot of my presentations remotely mm-hmm. instead of traveling, but I still sometimes there's still things that are important to go to. So I don't know. In 2021, if it's a smashing success, I'll still probably be working on it. And if it's a really impactful project, but if it's run its course, then I'll be moving on to other projects that are about engaging people around climate change in creative ways and to really try and work on shifting how we as a society really think about this issue. I've become really fascinated, not just with this project, but with art and music and books and podcasts and videos and what are all the things that we absorb every day in our culture? And do those things even talk about climate change at all? And how can we talk about it more in everything that is around us? And so that's kind of become my fascination.
Well, I think we're at this point in history where there's this huge explosion of opportunity in multimedia, in video, in on the internet with photography. We see how publishing is going through this incredible transformation. I just see that there is now ways to combine all of these various avenues of communication in new ways. And you have this incredibly powerful tool that you're using. You know, this sense of family, this sense of passion, love, and emotion. You don't find that anywhere else. I mean, you think of the type of information that we're relying on so much these days from CNN and Fox News, MSNBC, or even newspapers online, the New York Times and Washington Posts were inundated with statistics. But here you take an approach that is so personal, and yet it's so much more powerful to me. When I saw this on your website, and I briefly talked to you before, it was that sense that really, really hit me over the head and said, oh, I really want to talk to this woman. She has really got something so special and can be so impactful, and I want to work with her in whatever little way I can to help her cause.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, we're working to build this idea and to get it out there. So I really, really appreciate, you know, the opportunity to talk about the project. One thing, when you were talking, it brought up this one additional idea that I wanted to share.
Sure.
And that is, because you've said a couple of times that our project is very positive and very hopeful. And I do think that that part of the project, but what I think is really, really interesting about the project is that it provides a platform for people to talk about climate change in any way that they want to. Mm-hmm. And so we do find that people do talk about what they're doing, and they do talk about their hopes for the future. They also talk about their fears, what they are worried about losing, or they talk about, sometimes people talk about the apocalyptic vision of what the future could be. And the project actually allows people to hold both of those things mm-hmm. at the same time. And I think there's a lot of debate about how we should talk to people about climate change. Right. Should we just scare people, or should we just provide them the solutions mm-hmm. Or mm-hmm. just provide them hope? One thing that I think that has emerged from what I've seen in reading all the letters is that people have a capacity to hold all of those things at the same time. People have very complex feelings about climate change, and that we do provide a space. It's okay to say, like, this is really scary. I'm worried about these things, but this is what I hope for your life, and here's what I'm doing about it.
Yeah.
And those are really the most compelling and moving letters that we find, the ones that can kind of weave all of those themes together.
Well, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but there are two things that I want to know. One is the Yale study that you mentioned. Is that available online? And what is the name of that study?
Yeah, it's if you just type in the Six Americas.
Six Americas. Okay.
And Yale.
Okay.
You should easily be able to find it. And they've done a couple of versions. And I think the one I was referring to was from 2016. There actually might have been one after that. I'm not sure. I haven't looked at it in a couple months.
Well, that'll give people a place to mm-hmm. start anyway. Nothing like Google or Bing or some search engine. And maybe you can leave us with another one of your favorite letters or quotes that people have left on your site.
Yeah, so this letter I selected was also part of our top 10 for the year, and it was written by Josh Lawler, and it was written in June to his two children, and it's called Dear Finn and Sai. It's a long letter, but I'm just going to read part of it. He says, I can see you living in a city with buildings topped with solar panels and sided with living green walls. You'll ride electric trains and shuttles to work and ride bikes and electric scooters to run errands. Your power will come from solar, wind, and hydro. You'll eat locally grown food, mostly plants. Your air will be cleaner. Your city is quieter. People will be healthier. I do hope that is your world. The alternative is too hard to imagine. Yours, Dad.
Wow.
Is really beautiful.
That is really beautiful. Well, Jill, I want to thank you so much. This has been really wonderful. I think you provided a lot of great information, just a really wonderful story about some really important stuff. So thank you again for joining me today.
Well, thank you for, again, for providing the opportunity and for having these podcasts that you're obviously so, you know, inspired to do and to tell these stories, which is storytelling is really important.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Chip.
All right.
Thanks for listening today. Do you have an idea for a podcast? Let me know. Visit my website. You can contact me there or send me an email at chip@earthplus30.com. Until next time, this is Chip Spear.